Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with China's President Xi Jinping's $46 billion investment in Pakistan to build a new Silk Road known as the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, a network of roads, railway, and pipelines between China and the Pakistani port of Gwadar on the Indian Ocean. Political and strategic analyst Shuja Nawaz, who is the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council and author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to discuss Monday's extravagant summit in Islamabad, where these ambitious plans were announced, and possible impediments it faces from restive Uyghurs in China's far western provinces and a separatist insurgency in Balochistan, where the new Silk Road will meet the sea. Then, following an admission by Senator McCain, we will examine the payback Senate Republicans are inflicting on the Democrats by slow-walking their nominees in retaliation for the so-called nuclear option used in the last Congress to overcome a bottleneck of blocked appointments held up by Republican filibusters. A 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, Jim Manley, who was senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, joins us to discuss how this infantile behavior has ground the government to a halt. Then finally, we'll assess the just-concluded IMF spring meeting in Washington, at which the renewed possibility of Greece leaving the Eurozone got most of the attention. Domenico Lombardi, the director of the Global Economy Project at the Center for International Governance Innovation, joins us to discuss Greece as well as other global financial concerns about falling oil prices and the rising dollar. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian. And just a small correction, since we last spoke, I've stepped aside as director. I'm now a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center.
Okay, well, I will definitely note that. And tell me, what's your reaction to this $46 billion announcement in Islamabad today with a lot of pomp and ceremony, lots of Chinese and Pakistani flags? There seem to be a great deal of exuberance and obviously a lot of expectation. So what's your sense of whether this will come to fruition?
Well, clearly this is more a statement of intent than actual transformation of agreements on specific investments. The $46 billion figure is a collection of different sectors in which the Chinese and the Pakistanis are going to be working together over the next 15 years. And the largest sector in that is energy, which is roughly about $34 billion over the next 15 years. And then roads, which is about $6 billion. Rail, which is a little over $3.5 billion. A mass transit in Lahore City. Then the Gwadar port that you mentioned is $660 million, and then there's a China-Pakistan fiber optics investment, which is $0.04 billion. So that adds up to $46 billion. It's a pledge, and 51 different memoranda of understanding were signed today. Most of them were simply just protocols or formalization of earlier discussions. The actual investment projects which were agreed to today were just five. Most of them were in the hydropower or the wind power area. And clearly this was being seen by President Xi as being a signal that Pakistan and China's friendship remains strong, all-weather friendship as it's referred to. And this was also seen as a balancing of China's relationship with other countries in the region, including India, that the Chinese president had visited late last year, and where he had also pledged to make huge investments in Indian infrastructure.
So is there a possibility there with these proposals to bring gas from Iran across Balochistan into Pakistan? Would they? It's the logical thing was it would the pipe would continue on to India. So is any sense that there could be some kind of connection in terms of these deals that are just announced and India?
Not really, not a direct connection, because that the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline, or the IPI, is really dependent much more on two things. One, the normalization of relations between India and Pakistan, on which some work has begun, but there have been ups and downs. So two steps forward, one step back. And the other is the effects of the recent agreement, or framework, rather, for an agreement between Iran and the Western powers, which, if it leads to the removal of sanctions, will then reopen the issue of India joining the pipeline and Pakistan proceeding with it. The Chinese have offered to help Pakistan build its segment of the pipeline from Iran into Pakistan. But that's still an offer, and we are still waiting for the details of that.
And isn't there a problem in Balochistan with security? As I mentioned in the opening, there is also a problem with the rest of Uyghurs in the far west of China.
Absolutely. And actually, if you look at the economic corridor that China is proposing to help Pakistan build and to upgrade, because many of these roads exist within the country already, it starts off in Kashgar in Xinjiang and comes through the high Himalayas and the Karakoram down into the Punjab and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. And then one arm of it goes through Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is also a territory with a raging insurgency in the border region with Afghanistan. And that extends into Quetta in Balochistan and then down to Gwadar, which is also in Balochistan. The big thing here is that Gwadar was a port which the Chinese helped develop and which they are now managing for Pakistan, and to build it as a civilian counterpart to Dubai, and without being confined to the Persian Gulf's constraints. So there is a nationalist movement and an insurgency in Balochistan. There will be obviously challenges for Pakistan to bring the Baloch on board and to make them feel that they own the activity that is going to occur in their territory. Till now, every successive government in Pakistan has botched that. And so we'll have to see if the current government manages to handle that with care and attention.
And again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. And he's currently a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. So clearly, China and Pakistan's relationship goes back quite a long way, and they are have had a fairly enduring, as you've mentioned, all-weather friendship. But is there any elements in this deal that sort of recognize that the U.S. and Pakistan have sort of had a falling out?
Not really. Pakistan, I think, is going to be walking that a fine line between the United States and China. And if you recall, it's only in the last couple of weeks that an announcement was made that the administration has approved, and now Congress will need to sign off on the sale of about $1 billion worth of arms for Pakistan through the foreign military sales that are handled by the Department of State. This is going to assist Pakistan in the fight against the insurgency in the border region. And there are obviously going to be some issues in clearing it, but it probably will make it through. So the U.S. relationship still remains strong. However, when you compare the economic civilian assistance that the U.S. has provided since 2009, it only totals about $5 billion. So compared with this, the investment on the part of the Chinese of $46 billion over the next 15 years is quite considerable. I should interject here a little footnote of caution. The Chinese, unlike the U.S., do not give grants. They give loans, they make investments, and if there is a problem on the Pakistan side, they're willing to extend the length of the loan, the term of repayment, and even change the interest rate, but they never agree to transfer a loan into a grant. And so there's a big difference between the nature of Chinese assistance and investment in Pakistan and the nature of U.S. assistance. The U.S. has, over the years, given a lot of grant money to Pakistan. Secondly, the Chinese provide volume in terms of defense equipment. They've recently agreed to sell 8 silent nuclear submarines, which will allow Pakistan to retain a second strike capability if it ever gets into a nuclear exchange with India. They also have provided Pakistan the JF-17 fighter planes, which are being made in Pakistan. So the numbers are coming from China, but the quality products are still coming from the United States. And that's what the Pakistanis want, and they want to balance this relationship.
Well, but according to a Pew Research Center study in Pakistan, China is viewed as very favorably by 78% of Pakistanis, but a mere 14% of Pakistanis say they view the U.S. favorably. So there is a difference there, surely.
Absolutely. And according to the same set of Pew polls which have been conducted for the past few years, the U.S. is potentially considered enemy number one. In fact, India comes second. And the interesting paradox in the results of these polls is that another question which Pew asks people in Pakistan, do you want better relations with the United States? And regularly, 6 out of 10 Pakistanis say that they want better relations with the U.S. So we are still waiting to unpack those answers. I think ordinary Pakistanis, like the United States, would like to have an improved relationship, would like to travel, send their children to study here, and generally be friends with the United States while remaining friends with China. They don't see the two as conflicting with each other. It's the governments that have had differences, and governments in Pakistan, many of them autocratic or military governments that were not supported by the people, have sometimes made deals with the United States which have not taken into account the people's wishes. So that comes into this idea of the threat to Pakistan.
And, of course, the U.S., as you just mentioned, is selling 15 new AH-1Z Viper helicopters, a $1 billion sale.
Yes.
So in spite of that, the U.S. is still obviously, in terms of the arms trade, is still working with Pakistan. Now, you mentioned that the Chinese submarines. My understanding is that aren't they diesel-electric submarines? They're not nuclear submarines.
No, they're not nuclear-powered, but they're very silent, and therefore they would be hard to detect. And that is why the Pakistanis have purchased these 8 new submarines, because at the moment, Pakistan does not really have a second strike capacity. India has an announced no first strike capacity. So if ever the two countries, God forbid, go into a nuclear exchange, which would be devastating for the region and the world, this is part of Pakistan's strategy to be able to retain an offshore capacity to retaliate. I mean, obviously, no sane person would want this to come to pass in the region or in the globe, but this is part of their military calculus.
And would these diesel electric submarines that China's supplying Pakistan, would they be able to launch ballistic missiles from underwater, or would they be launching cruise missiles with nuclear tips? Are they, I mean, how advanced are they?
They can launch missiles that are nuclear armed. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really the main reason why the Pakistanis have acquired them.
So how does India feel about this idea that China has built, will build this road all the way from China through the disputed Kashmir area, past Islamabad, and then all the way down to Gwadar on the Arabian Sea, on the Indian Ocean? And that would suggest to me that maybe that would afford China also a lot of access to the Indian Ocean. Not obviously, they may be able to shortcut a lot of their oil supplies and other supplies from the Middle East, but they, on the other hand, China does have a have an interest in protecting its sea lanes to, at this point, I understand.
Absolutely. China has a dual policy of a ground-based Silk Route as well as what they call a maritime Silk Route, which the famous Booz Allen study of 2002, I think, for the Department of Defense, it called the String of Pearls theory, where China was making alliances with countries, the literal states of the Indian Ocean, including Myanmar and Sri Lanka and Pakistan, to see that it had access to ports. That String of Pearls really is a U.S. theory. It is not a Chinese strategy, but the Chinese certainly do want to maintain trade links with countries in the Indian Ocean. And although they've recently had a setback in Sri Lanka with the change of government there, but with Myanmar, with Bangladesh, and now with Pakistan, they are developing these commercial ports, which will allow them to use these bases for reaching markets in the Middle East as well as in Africa.
Well, clearly, though, China is concerned about the Muslim separatists in the Uyghurs, and they also, aren't they concerned about links to terrorism and to some of the Pakistani, I mean, some of the terrorist groups in Pakistan and Afghanistan on the border area, you know, where you have this kind of, you know, jihadi kind of international brigade, if you will, including Chechens and all kinds of people. I believe there's some Uyghurs as well.
You're absolutely right. Although the number of Uyghurs is quite small, but China is trying to go for prevention rather than the cure. The numbers that have been bandied about are not even in the scores. And this includes members of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. But paradoxically, China's policy of one belt, one road for creating regional stability and opening an economic corridor through Pakistan to the Persian Gulf will also open the door to traffic of these separatist and nationalistic ideas and militancy affecting Xinjiang, its western province. And so China is going to use its economic and political clout with Pakistan to get Pakistan to stop that backflow of militancy, even as Pakistan is fighting militants at home. China is also very critically interested in Afghanistan and its stability. And I should mention that the first foreign visit of President Ashraf Ghani in Afghanistan was to Beijing. And that was in order to ensure that the Chinese investments in Afghanistan would continue and that China would build infrastructure links to Afghanistan as well. And I think they would like to retain that access to Afghanistan's natural resources and then perhaps link it up with the roadways going through Pakistan so that they can then ship things back to China as well as process them and then ship them out to the Middle East from basic economic bases and manufacturing plants in Pakistan and perhaps even Afghanistan.
Well, just in closing, Sujan Nawaz, clearly the Chinese have a lot riding on these deals, and the Pakistanis certainly have raised expectations. Given how the U.S. and Pakistan's relationship went on the rocks, is there any chance that Pakistan may drop the ball here? I mean, What's your sense of this whole thing coming to fruition?
Well, in terms of the promise of the memorandums of understanding, the MOUs that has been talked about, and 51 of them were signed today, the previous government of Pakistan under President Asif Ali Zardari, as a result of many trips by him to China, also produced a lot of MOUs. But the investments never came to fruition. And largely because there wasn't counterpart financing available in Pakistan, nor was there the private or the public sector capacity to implement those plans at the same pace as the Chinese wanted them to. So this will be a test for Pakistan and for the new government in Pakistan. And so I don't think that we should begin celebrating everything at this point. It's a 15-year deal, and the ideal would be for them to develop things slowly. The other thing to keep in mind is that much though Pakistani politicians like to show China as an alternative to relationships with the United States, businessmen and even the military in their heart of hearts would much rather retain the U.S. relationship. And so it's not a question of substituting one for the other, but maintaining both. And you have to remember that the China-Pakistan trade is not very large. It is still of the order of about $12 billion at most, and most of it is in favor of China because their consumer products have basically wiped the Pakistani consumer market out, and that's what they're doing in the region in general.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Shuja Nawaz.
It's a great pleasure, Ian, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Shuja Nawaz is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. And he is currently a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Republican payback for the Democrats for their nuclear option in the Senate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks for having me once again.
And Jim, John McCain, Senator John McCain, has in effect admitted that the GOP is slow-walking Obama's nominees, that they're still mad at Harry Reid for the filibuster rules, the so-called nuclear option. And the feeling that I get, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have, is that is this the United States Senate or some kind of kindergarten?
Well, I mean, based on what I've seen recently, it's getting pretty damn close to kindergarten. But, you know, under the rules of the Senate, any one senator has the right to throw up, you know, these kind of roadblocks. In Senator McCain's defense, at least he's publicly admitted it, which is not always the case. But the fact of the matter is he's gone, once again, way too far. And this is not the way the founders of the Constitution intended the Senate to operate when they concocted the Senate, you know, more than 200 years ago.
Well, John McCain, in admitting that they're slow-walking the nominees as payback, said, I told him, talking about Harry Reid, I told him, you jam them through, it's going to be a long time before I approve them. And there are 18 nominations waiting for a vote on the Senate floor, including Loretta Lynch for the Attorney General, and another...
Who, by the way, he's been a vocal opponent of.
And there are more than 130 idling in committees. So, I mean, the Republicans are just throwing sand in the gears of government.
Yeah. Let's focus on the Loretta Lynch nomination for a second, shall we?
Sure.
What's his basic beef with her? That she actually has a temerity to uphold the views of the president that she wants to serve. He and other Republicans still can't get over the fact that Barack Obama was elected twice to be the president of the United States. The idea that she's being held up because she reflects the views of the president she wants to serve is absolutely outrageous. And again, it's once again Republicans grinding the Senate down to a halt. To such a situation where the framers of this country can't recognize it right now.
So in terms of the Senate hold and the prerogatives, one senator can basically hold up a nomination, right? And they don't have to identify who they are.
The rules are a little bit more tight these days, but there is always ways to get around them. So they're supposed to be identified. More often than not, they're not. Like I said, in Senator McCain's defense, at least he's publicly admitted what... members like, I don't know, let's say David Vitter, usually hide behind anonymity. So, but like I said before, the idea that they are taking it this far, undercutting the national security of this country by refusing to process these nominees is absolutely outrageous. Now, the good news is we at least did the first judge last week, the first judge so far this year. Again, that's part of their retaliatory effort. The Senate so far this year hasn't confirmed any judges. So you know, that's one slight indication maybe things are thawing a little bit. But again, Senator McCain in this interview really threw another monkey wrench up there.
Well, apparently there are 23 judicial emergencies across the nation's courts. And this, of course, it seems that... pleas from the Chief Justice John Roberts literally are falling on deaf ears to his fellow Republicans.
Oh, some of the Republicans most proud of their efforts to stall, stop, and delay nominations come from some of the states affected, including the two from Texas, for instance. These folks are once again pressing the outer limits of what founding fathers thought of when they put together the Senate more than 200 years. It's not only John Roberts, but like I said, all sorts of scholarly writers have identified problem after problem with the backlog, and yet senators from even the home states won't even agree to it because they just want to stick it to the president.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. And in terms of what Harry Reid managed, and this was in the case of relentless obstruction, when they changed the rules on the filibuster, he was able to get through 96 judges and 302 executive branch nominees using this so-called nuclear option, which only required a simple majority vote. Now, at the time, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, that could backfire. Obviously, as long as Obama's in office, because of this, what some people call the Obama derangement syndrome, this irrational hatred of this man that so many Republicans have, it's unlikely that they're going to cooperate in any way. But what happens if we end up with a Republican president and with a Republican Senate and a Republican House? Won't that mean that they can push through their wish list of judicial nominations?
It could, yeah. That'll be if and when we get to that point. I'm not convinced we are. That is something I think that they would give strong consideration to. There is a vocal part of Senator McConnell's caucus that charges that since Senator Reid did what he did, Senate Republicans should take the next step and do away with the filibuster once and for all, the rendering of the Senate just like the House. It's also true that there is any number of mostly senior Senate Republicans that realizes that, in fact, would be a mistake, and that whatever had been done in the past it certainly didn't call for, you know, doing away, like I said, with the rest of the filibuster options. For right now, it's kind of interesting. You know, Senator McConnell is pretty comfortable where things are. He made no effort to go back to the 60-vote threshold or like that. They're kind of comfortable with the current situation. But, you know, what's going to happen in 2016 or in 2017 after the election remains to be seen. So,
well, so what is the chance then of any kind of a deal being reached here? I mean, particularly on the Attorney General. One of the strange things about this obstruction with the replacement for the current Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, is that, you know, apparently she's incredibly qualified. Nobody argues about that. She's got stellar references from a lot of big named Republicans. Mm-hmm. I think Rudy Giuliani, Governor Pataki, et cetera.
Old Alberto Gonzalez came out for her today. Yep.
And, you know, as long as she's not seated, they've still got the Attorney General that they hate, Eric Holder.
They hate almost as much as life itself. That's the irony of the situation, isn't it? As long as they're stalling, Eric Holder is going to continue to be the Attorney General. But the fact of the matter is, despite these comments by Senator McCain, I think there is a pretty good chance that finally, by the end of the week, Loretta Lynch is going to be confirmed. Breaking just about every rule length that she's held out there. But I think, in fact, this may be the week where things come together and they wrap up this so-called human trafficking bill and then moved to confirm Loretta Lynch after a couple days' worth of debate. And, you know, again, despite the fact that a lot of folks think she's highly qualified, in the end she's probably only going to be confirmed with a bare minimum, maybe 51, 52, 53 votes. There's only, as you may know, there's only five Republican senators so far as on record as saying they're going to support her. So that's, like I said, the bare minimum 51. So somehow I don't think the vice president's going to be traveling this week in case things fall apart and they need an extra vote. Let's put it that way.
And there are nine other judicial nominations waiting on the Senate floor and 11 are pending in the Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. One of them, of course, is the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, who mm-hmm. would be Loretta Lynch's number two. So, you know, is there any chance you could do a deal there, or are they just going to do these piecemeal?
Yeah, no. If there was a time when you could package deals, that time has come and gone. These are going to have to be done on a case-by-case basis. Again, after all, you know, it's taken the Senate at least 3 weeks, if not more, to pass this human trafficking bill that should have been done by a voice vote in a matter of 5 minutes. It's now taken a couple weeks. Because Republicans loaded it up with abortion-related language that many Democrats found highly objectionable. So, that's not the way things work. I mean, no sign of a deal there. They're going to have to nominate a new head of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms as well. The NRA traditionally, you know, opposes whoever that nominee is. So things aren't going to change anytime soon.
Well, the NRA actually likes ATF not to have any leaders. That was the case for a number of years, right?
Yes, they do, as a matter of fact. That is correct. But at some point, the president's going to have to make a move and try and push for that nominee. But that's going to have to wait a little bit.
So is there any sense then of I thought that sort of Senator Corker was one of the reasonable people. He actually didn't he make a prediction that maybe Loretta Lynch would get through this week?
I think he did on the Sunday show this weekend. I'm here to tell you as well that I think that's where things are going. Again, it's only going to be with a bare minimum, 51, 52 votes. But after, you know, being held up for 1,000-some-odd days, whatever that number is, you know, I think she's finally going to be confirmed. And again, it's not because, well, let me put it like this. I mean, very few people are questioning her qualifications. What I find highly objectionable is that many Republicans are vowing to vote against her because she actually has the temerity to support the administration's proposals. And I think, you know, I don't know how screwed up politics could become that you could criticize a nominee for voicing support for the president that you support. But, you know, I guess that's the way Republicans are calling things these days.
So why did John McCain then support Ashton Carter for Secretary of Defense? He didn't slow walk him. And
Yeah, I mean, he cited national security concerns, the fact with, you know, parts of the world spiraling out of control in Afghanistan and the Middle East needed a strong national security proponent in that place. I mean, again, the irony is that, you know, he's highly qualified, just like Loretta Lynch is, to be the next AG. But so, you know, as always, as most politicians do, he found his exception. He pushed Ash Carter forward, and then he's, you know, taking all his marbles and going home in a, you know, bit of a snit. So not realizing, of course, again, that his actions could be described as undercutting, you know, key national security concerns by failing to confirm any of these others that are out there.
Well, though, it seems that Senator McCain has been in a bit of a snit since he was defeated by Obama back in 2008. I mean, you know, he recently, in his floor speech, called upon Israel to go rogue and bomb Iran. I mean, yeah. I don't think we've seen that kind of, not so much behavior, I guess, but that kind of rhetoric in the U.S. Senate openly, you know. I mean, fortunately, senators don't declare war, right?
yeah, exactly. Well, what am I supposed to say to that? I mean, the guy's been all over the map in the last couple of years. He zigs between bipartisanship and then, again, making floor speeches like you just referenced, and or, again, drawing this line in the sand as he did against these nominees. So, you know, they have a base that is very loud, very active, very aggressive, demanding, you know, that they just push the president come hell or high water. And, you know, Senator McCain usually is in the forefront of those kind of actions. So, you know, when it comes to the foreign policy itself, I mean, you know, he along with Senator Graham are part of the, you know, bomb first, ask questions later crowd. So no surprise there.
Well, but there is a distinct difference between how the Democrats, when they controlled the Senate, allowed George W. Bush's nominations to go through. There is, you know, no comparison. So is this just...
Yeah, none whatsoever. I mean, again, these guys have taken their animus towards this president to a new extreme. They refuse to acknowledge that this president was duly elected by the people of this country twice to be the president of the United States, and as such, he deserves to have his own representatives at these agencies.
And there was, of course, Senator DeMint, I think, had the record of obstruction, but he's no longer there. And Vitter, I take it, has taken on that mantle in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of them that are proud to follow in that tradition, but Senator Vitter is no doubt one of the best at it. You know that paragon of virtue, if you will, is more than willing to attack one good person after another for one, you know, alleged reason or another. So, but I gave up paying attention to Senator Vitter a long time ago. So,
well, just in closing, then, Jim Manley, is there anybody in that Senate on the Republican side that is reminiscent of your father's or your grandfather's GOP?
They're becoming few and far between. Currently, I'm watching Senator Bob Corker try and figure out how to navigate the waters that are swirling around him. He stepped forward a couple years ago and tried to cut a deal on a bailout for the auto industry at a time when the economy was tanking, and the right grabbed him and pushed him away, and then he ended up walking away from the deal. Right now, he's putting together a bipartisan consensus on the Iran legislation. Say what you will about the particulars of the bill. What I'm trying to point out is that he understands that the best way to deal with a policy like this is getting input from Democrats and not rushing things. And he's on several different occasions stood up to members of his caucus, including Tom Cotton, and said, not so fast. We're going to do this on a bipartisan basis. So we'll see. You know, centrists within that caucus are usually roadkill, so we'll see how it plays out. But, you know, what am I supposed to say? You know, Lyndon Johnson had Ev Dirksen to work with. Senator Reid has got Mitch McConnell to work with. It's not really a fair comparison.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley. He's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the IMF summit that just wrapped up in Washington, D.C. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Domenico Lombardi, who is the director of the Global Economy Program at the Center for International Governance Innovation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Domenico Lombardi.
Hello to everybody.
And Domenico, the IMF meeting just took place, and there it looks as though Greece is coming back. You know, I thought for a while there the situation with Greece was being handled, but now it appears that the IMF are kind of worried, and there's a new standoff between the Greek government and the IMF and the European Union.
Indeed, this is absolutely correct. Greece was not an official item on these meetings here in Washington, and yet was the topic of most of official as well as non-official conversations occurring at the margin of these meetings. The issue is that the IMF and the European lenders, that is the EU and the ECB, have asked the new cabinet that was elected in January to come up with a list of ready-to-go reforms. And on that, however, the cabinet has hesitated to come up with this list. Essentially, there has been a standoff, and it looks likely at this stage, as of today, that Greece might not make the next payment to the IMF coming due over the next few days. Clearly, there is still time to go, and it is very possible that the situation is going to be resolved. Clearly, it's in neither party interest to escalate the tension, while it is certainly in the best interest of the global economy and the global financial system to try to remedy to the current situation. So that was the main item that did attract a lot of attention here in Washington.
Well, also in Washington, at an event at the Brookings Institution, Greece's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, said that Greece would no longer take part in what he referred to as the extend and pretend of rolling over debt. Quoting him, he said, "We've tried that medicine, but it hasn't worked." He's being pretty combative, isn't he?
Yeah, that's correct. And unfortunately, this is not contributing to a healthy discussion with the lenders. Clearly, the new cabinet does want more time to come up with a list of country-owned reforms. On the other hand, the lenders do say that the cabinet came to office last January, and since January, they have not legislated one single reform.
Well, there was an extraordinary comment coming from a former IMF economist, Peter Doyle, who is a 20-year veteran of the IMF. He left the IMF in anger back in 2012, saying he was ashamed that he worked there. And he's basically arguing that the IMF should be less secretive and more public. And he's particularly critical of the treatment of Greece. basically saying that the IMF stance is counterproductive in face of a euro tinderbox before it explodes. So how do you see the situation, Domenico?
I think the comments by Mr. Doyle clearly were referring to, you know, the moment those comments were made, when the program was indeed a little bit too harsh. It did figure overly in exceeding fiscal adjustment. And these are points that, now they've been taken. I think right now it is pretty much consensus that moving forward, the programs must be much more sort of balanced. However, in order to get the ball rolling, the lenders would need a list of country-owned ready-to-go reforms that this cabinet plans to implement. So, in other words, the source of the tension is not whether the lenders want to impose an overly excessive fiscal adjustment anymore. Certainly, that was an issue until recently. But right now, the source of tension is more, in terms of the new cabinet producing a policy platform that the lenders can buy in.
In terms of other global financial issues, the IMF has said that they're very concerned about countries that export oil and other commodities. They're also concerned about sudden moves in the global currency markets, particularly with the value of the dollar increasing, which of course increases repayment burdens on countries that have borrowed U.S. dollars. What's your sense of the broader economic landscape?
All in all, the global economic outlook looks much better today than it did a year ago or even 6 months ago. Oil prices have gone down. And of course, whenever this happens, there are countries losing, typically the oil exporting economies. But there are also a whole bunch of countries benefiting from decreasing oil prices, that is the oil importing countries. And on top of that, we do see that the Eurozone crisis has now stabilized. The economic outlook for the Eurozone is now much better. We see growth not just in the core, that is not just in France or Germany, but we also see growth in the periphery, for instance, Spain, projected to grow at 2% this year. Italy, which has gone through a protracted period of contraction in GDP, is also going to grow this year, albeit at a small rate of 0.5%. And the emerging economies in Asia are still doing relatively fine. India, China, they are still growing at quite high rates. And therefore, all in all, the outlook looks much more benign. We have recessions in Brazil, in Russia. However, the overall outlook is certainly much better than it was until a few months ago.
Well, my understanding is that the debt repayment strain is affecting Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, and of course Nigeria is also being affected by the drop in oil prices, as is Venezuela and Russia. Any sense that you have that any of these countries are going to reach a crisis point?
I think it's still too early to say. Certainly these economies are going through some stress this year. And it clearly depends on how these countries will be quick to respond in terms of corrective policies. And if they do not, certainly some of them might have to undergo an externally funded adjustment program. But, countries like Brazil have shown a certain degree of resilience. Their policymakers are pretty skilled, and certainly they know the way forward to address these challenges. Russia is a completely different case. Clearly, Russia is being hit by not just the decreasing oil prices, but also by the sanctions, and therefore this can have not just spillovers within the Russian economy, but also with the neighboring economies with which Russia trades. And therefore, you know, we do see signs of distress in these economies, but clearly more, you know, we need to look at the short-term developments and how policymakers in these countries will respond to the challenges.
Well, one of the problems that these countries have, in particular Russia, is the outflows of capital. Isn't that a big factor?
Indeed, and we have indeed seen substantial outflows of capital, again, triggered by the escalation of the sanctions, triggered by the increasing uncertainty and the increasing political isolation in which Russia today finds itself. Clearly, it's an open question until when Russia is able to withstand these sources of pressure. And so far what we see is that the Russian economy looks increasingly weak.
Well, what do you think is going to happen when the Federal Reserve starts to raise interest rates later this year? It could really throw the global markets into turmoil. I mean, I guess it just has to be done very carefully, and I'm not sure how that can be done. What's your sense?
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve has been very cautious in alerting markets about the expected rate increase. So this is not going to come as a surprise, and they expect that the Federal Reserve will pay increasingly more attention in communicating to markets their plans in terms of forthcoming interest rate rise. Certainly, when this happens, we may see some stress in economies that have already been hit by capital outflows. And again, a lot will depend on how these economies will ring-fence themselves, on how they will be able to put in place corrective measures, both in terms of counteracting monetary policy measures, as well as so-called macroprudential measures aimed at stabilizing the financial system. But one thing should be noted, that the Federal Reserve has indeed tried to alert market participants, economies abroad, of their monetary policy plans in the coming months.
Well, so just back to Greece, and as you mentioned earlier, the big International Monetary Fund's spring meeting in Washington that just concluded was not expected to be basically dominated by Greece, but there it is, you know, the sort of 900-pound gorilla, if you will. But when Mario Draghi says the short-term danger of contagion from a Greek exit is difficult to assess, but we have enough buffers in place, and even though they were designed for different circumstances, they are sufficient, but we are entering uncharted waters. And on top of that, the European Central Bank is basically saying that basically that Greece could exit the euro. So uncharted waters, that's, a little dramatic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But it's not the first time that Greece has provided us with surprises. First of all, we have to recognize that even if Greece defaults, that doesn't automatically imply that Greece is going to leave the eurozone. We can still have Greece going through another adjustment program, through a debt restructuring that would, help the Greek economy to go back on track. Leaving the eurozone is indeed a possibility, clearly, that cannot be excluded. And I think what President Draghi was referring to was the fact that, yes, now the eurozone is much better equipped. First of all, the ECB has become much more aggressive in its monetary policy stance. It has embarked on a quantitative easing, started a few weeks ago, And now there are firewalls. There is the Permanent Rescue Fund mechanism, the ESM, that has now been set up. However, we can, because this is an event that has never happened so far, you know, a country leaving a currency union, there is still uncertainty in terms of the possible implications. And I think, this residual uncertainty is something that, President Draghi is very well aware of. And this is also something that clearly should, catch our attention, because no matter how high these firewalls are, there is still uncertainty that something unaccounted for might happen, and that the Greek exit might trigger something that is not fully foreseen.
Well, Greece asked for delay in its debt payments, which are due next month, and the IMF turned them down. My understanding is that the monitors or demands that these reforms that Greece has pledged to undertake should be monitored by Brussels, and aid is supposed to be tied to detailed targets that the Greek government have arrived at or agreed on. But my understanding is that there's not a lot of transparency, that the ECB and the IMF don't really know about the real state of Greek finances, and there's a concern that in the next few weeks Greece could run out of money to pay for its welfare, public sector wages, and it certainly can't pay its debt repayments on top of all of that. So do you have a feeling that we're coming to a crunch here?
I think there's still some time to go, time in which the parties can arrive at a mutual agreement. And in the end, I do think that it's in it's not in the interest of either party to escalate this tension to the extreme. In other words, if Greece were not to repay the IMF, clearly would lose an important source of financial support, and by doing so would be unable to pay salaries, pensions. Clearly salaries and pensions that are at the heart, that are extremely needed by those who have voted for Syriza last January. So this is something to keep very much in mind, and I think this is also something that the current government would wish to avoid. Clearly they are on a very tough negotiating stance. They want to extract as many concessions as possible. And maybe this is why they are pushing things a little bit too far. That said, we still have a few more weeks or days to go, and I would expect that things could stabilize as we really approach the real deadline.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Domenico Lombardi.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Domenico Lombardi, who's the director of the Global Economy Program at the Center for International Governance Innovation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.